You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And we have now more than 30 states who are represented by people who have started petitions over on the White House website. And you've got to have 25,000 signatures on your petition for the White House to review the petition and comment on it. Louisiana is now at 29,000, Texas at 76,000. So they're both well over the 25,000 mark threshold. And it's just remarkable. Is Thomas Naylor on the phone, or he's not on my board unless he's on line one? Yeah. So anyway, I find this just fascinating. I don't even see one for Vermont. Nobody has apparently started a petition for Vermont to secede, but there is a secessionist movement in Vermont, a long one, an old one. Thomas Naylor is the founder of the Second Vermont Republic, Vermont's secessionist movement. VermontRepublic.org is their website. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Oh, greetings, Tom. It's good to be back.
Great to have you back with us. How goes the fight to secede?
Well, the last 4 years under Obama have been a pretty tough sell because, as your listeners know, Vermont's a rather left-wing state, and the political left perceived Obama as the second coming of Jesus Christ.
Well, I haven't heard that.
The last four...
I have heard that he's the Antichrist from people on the right.
Have not been easy.
But he is liked. Yeah, sure.
Yes.
So it's not going so well, apparently. I'm curious your take on these...
The last 4 years, I said, were difficult.
Right. Now, Vermont, I believe, is one of the states that for every dollar it sends into the government, it gets less than a dollar back. That's typical of blue states anyway. The red states, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, they all get back more than a dollar for every dollar they send to Washington, D.C. And these are the states...
On how you calculate it, you can show that Vermont picks up a few cents as well.
Vermont may as well, okay. Yeah, well, there's a lot of rural poor in Vermont. I think a lot of people overlook that. You've got Burlington and Montpelier that are sort of little urban pockets of yuppification or whatever, but much of Vermont is rural and poor, and so it may well be. So the question, should these, what is motivating, particularly in a state that gets more in federal dollars than they send, what is motivating the people in Louisiana and Texas who have both crashed through this 25,000 signature threshold over at the White House website? What's motivating them?
Well, they're really in a different business than we're in, Tom. I think it's a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the re-election of Obama. You know, they really don't like Obama. And we're not, while we find this very interesting, it's kind of really not our cup of tea. You may have noticed we're not one of the states who's signed the petition and have no plans to do so. Among other things, the idea of asking the president for permission to secede, that is not something we would ever do. Our view is that we have a constitutional right to secede that was built into the 10th Amendment.
Well, this is what Justice Scalia says, if I may.
What did you say?
If I may quote him. These are his words. He said, to begin with, the answer is clear. If there was any constitutional issue resolved by the Civil War, it is that there is no constitutional right to secede. Hence, in the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation, indivisible. Secondly, I find it difficult to envision who the parties to this lawsuit might be. Is the state suing the United States for declaratory judgment? But the United States cannot be sued without its consent, and it has not consented to this sort of suit. I'm sure that the poetic license can overcome all that, but you do not need good legal advice for that. Good luck.
Huh.
That's Justice Scalia.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't agree with him typically. constitutional issues, but wasn't this issue of secession resolved by the Civil War?
No.
Why not?
Well, there are three quick and dirty reasons as to why we think it's constitutional, legal to secede. And one, I already alluded to, the 10th Amendment, which basically said if the Constitution does not forbid something by inference that's left up to the states, the Constitution does not forbid secession, and so take it from there. A couple of other arguments are that when Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York came into the Union, they each had escape clauses built into their constitutions. If they have the option to escape, what about the other 47 of us?
Were those timed escape clauses, or do they still stand?
I'm not sure whether they are.
Because my understanding is that when Texas became an independent state, that they negotiated a deal, and I don't know if it's written into their constitution or if there's some, you know, correspondence with the United States or whatever, that if they decide, because Texas, like Vermont, was an independent, the only two states in the country that were independent nations
right.
before they joined the United States,
right.
that they retain, now this is, you know, what I hear from the people around Rick Perry, that Texas retains to this day the right to secede, to remove itself from the Union. So there may be four states,
and
but in any
the
case...
The other argument was back in the pre-Civil War and nullification, and, you know, there were a dozen or so states who had nullified the Constitution.
Yeah, but nullification was knocked down by the Supremacy Clause.
Related to slavery.
Yeah.
If they can nullify, can any state do that?
Right. So your take on this is that Louisiana, Texas, these southern states, the North Carolina, 20,000 signatures right now, South Carolina, 11,000 signatures, Mississippi, 13,000. I mean, you know, some of them are getting up there. Florida's at 22,000, getting close to that 25,000 mark. That the people from these states who are talking about seceding from the Union are doing it in reaction to President Obama being elected president. Why are you doing it in Vermont?
Well, first of all, our movement is really 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It was in response not to Obama, but to George W. Bush.
Uh-huh.
But George W. Bush was the greatest thing that ever happened. I mean, he put us on the map, so to speak.
Your secession movement.
So
right.
we're running against Bush, not Obama. And then increasingly, we actually want to distance ourselves from even the use of the word secession. It is such a highly toxic word.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Abraham Lincoln really did a number on the country 150 years ago, convincing both the left and the right that secession is bad. It's one of the few topics in which they can agree on.
Right.
And we're much more interested now in identifying with the small, nonviolent, eco-friendly, sustainable, democratic, socially responsible countries like Sweden, Finland, Denmark.
So you want to become a democratic socialist republic?
We want to play in a different sandbox,
right?
Than just being, you know, playing. You know, we're not unsympathetic with what they're doing, and clearly it's a loud voice of agitation against the federal government,
right?
And we're sympathetic to that.
Right.
But kind of a knee-jerk reaction to Obama. And you know, heaven forbid, we're no fans of Obama. We consider Obama basically, a techno-fascist warmonger disguised as a liberal.
Uh-huh. A cleaner, gentler, a nicer, gentler George W. Bush sort of thing. Interesting. Thomas Naylor, the founder of the Second Vermont Republic, vermontrepublic.org is the website. Thomas, thanks for dropping by today.
My pleasure.
Great talking with you again. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, should individual states be allowed to withdraw themselves to secede from the Union? Should we refight the Civil War if they do?
Should I stay or should I go now?
Should we secede? So it appears there are tens of thousands of Americans across the nation who want their states to withdraw from the Union. This is a process, as I mentioned earlier, called secession. Apparently, because that whole secession thing went so well last time it was tried back during the Lincoln administration. All right. Since the election, the White House's website has been inundated with petitions to grant peaceful secession to more than 20 states, mostly from people in the South, but also from right-wing wackadoodles in blue states like New York, New Jersey, and Michigan. As one petition from Texas, which has gotten more than 70,000 signatures, reads, "Given that the state of Texas maintains a balanced budget and is the 15th largest economy in the world, it is practically feasible for Texas to withdraw from the Union, and to do so would protect its citizens' standard of living and re-secure their rights and liberties in accordance with the original ideals and beliefs of our founding fathers, which are no longer being reflected by the federal government." An official with Republican, end of quote. An official with the Republican Party in Texas has also endorsed the idea. Peter Morrison, the treasurer of the Hardin County Republican Party, called for secession in his post-election newsletter, writing, quote, "Texas was once its own country, and many Texans already think in nationalist terms about their state. Why should Vermont and Texas live under the same government? Let each go our own way in peace. Sign a free trade agreement among the states, and we can avoid this gut-wrenching spectacle every 4 years." Texas Governor Rick Perry, no stranger to Texas secessionist talk either. Back in 2009, he infamously said that Texas is a unique place. And he added that it was given special privileges when it was admitted as a state back in 1845 to be able to leave the Union whenever it feels like it. I guess he found that little historical tidbit in one of those school books recently rewritten by the reactionary Texas School Board. Clearly, 4 years of President Obama has been too much for some of the loopier conservatives across the country. I mean, these people are just, oh, we want the good old days. You know, when the private health insurance companies could say, no, sorry, you're going to die. We're not going to pay for your pre-existing condition. Or when women were guaranteed to make a smaller paycheck than men for doing the same work. Heck, let's go back to the help wanted ads. Ladies wanted, men wanted. Let's defy. You know, and in America, where gays and lesbians are regarded as second class citizens. But secession, seriously, is a damn drastic move. I mean, sure, the nation might be better off without a dozen or so red states standing in the way of things like single-payer health care, carbon caps, and employee-run unions. And sure, it might be best in the long run if the Ron and Rand Paul crazies are let loose to once and for all try to create their own libertarian paradise, complete with daily pledges to the flag of Ayn Rand, just so they can see for themselves why libertarian attempts at society have failed everywhere they've ever been tried any time in the history of the world. I mean, you know, secession, if done peacefully, wouldn't be the worst thing for the world, and certainly not for the rest of us here in America, but I can't help but worry about those hapless progressives in cities like Austin, Texas, and Athens, Georgia, who are surrounded by these rabid right-wing secessionists. Or even the good Democrats who live in rural, hard red areas, but watch us on satellite TV or on Sirius XM radio. Listen to us and are hanging on for friends and family. Seriously, there are no red states or blue states. We all live in purple states, with both conservatives, progressives, and everything in between. Some states just have more of one or the other than other states. And we can't condemn red state progressives to the libertarian dystopia that the secessionists want to create. It's inhumane. So then what's to be done? Well, luckily for all of us, our progressive neighbor to the north, Canada, may have a solution. A number of reports have surfaced post-election that Canada is offering up a deal to conservatives in America who just can't handle an America governed by Barack Obama. So far, these rumors have yet to be, or these reports have yet to be verified. They're just internet rumor, and they haven't been confirmed by the Canadian government. But given that actual facts bear little significance in the conservative worldview, there's some buzz that some conservatives are already looking into this refuge offer as an alternative to secession and a civil war. I'm not making this up. It's all over the web. According to this so-called deal for disgruntled Americans, Canada's opening up its northernmost province of Nunavut to anyone from the states who just can't stomach another 4 years of President Obama's ruthless, tyrannical, moderate rule. Each immigrant is going to get 40 acres of land conveniently open near, located near open water. So when oceans go up, they can, well, and Canada is also generously offering a used snowmobile and a sled to any newcomers as well. No doubt that life in Nunavut, fending for yourself without any help from the nanny state, will take some getting used to, especially for those southerners who hail from states that receive more government benefits than they pay in tax revenue. Not to mention the weather's a little different in Nunavut than it is in Florida, but The weather woes shouldn't last too long. Global warming could soon turn it into a climate like today's New York. It may only take a generation or three. And hopefully a deal can be worked out between the new oligarchs of Nunavut, and the Canadian government to absolutely make sure that the horrors of single-payer health care, which all Canadians have access to, not to mention gay marriage, never cross the border into that new libertarian refuge in the Arctic. I think that's the best solution for all. The conservatives get their freedom from President Obama, while progressives here in the United States find an electorate much more receptive to their ideals. Thanks to one local Fox News station in Oklahoma, soon-to-be secessionists now even know the easiest way to make it to Canada without getting stuck in traffic. So let's wish them well. Now, on the other hand, Louise and I were up on the Great Slave Lake and Yellowknife in what was then the Northwest Territories. Oh, geez, this was 10, 15 years ago. I gave a weekend workshop for Indigenous people from all over the state. Don Morin, who was the premier of the territory, of the Northwest Territories, an area just about as large as the United States. I mean, it's just huge. Flew into Fort Resolution. There's a big meeting house there, a giant log cabin. I mean, it's just massive, the size of a modern-day school building here in the United States. Flew in tribal leaders, indigenous elders, from literally the entire Northwest Territory, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, all across northern Canada. And we spent the weekend talking about how to invent educational systems that work for Indigenous people. And I can tell you, there's a bunch of people who actually live up there in Nunavut, and they will not be pleased if a bunch of libertarian crackpots and wackadoodles in the United States are showing up going, where's the flag with Ayn Rand's picture on it? We need to salute it. Somehow I think this ain't going to work. This dog won't hunt.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Which raises the obvious question, what do we say to all these people signing these petitions? America, love it or leave it, but go where? Where can they go? Ah, the perfect secession song. It's amazing. Pat Buchanan, it is not 1860 again, but with all the talk of the 10th Amendment, nullification and interposition, states' rights and secession, following Governor Rick Perry's misstatement that Texas on entering the Union in 1845 reserved in its constitutional right to secede, one might think so. So Pat Buchanan debunking Rick Perry. That's interesting. Amazing. Okay, Ken in Prince Albert, Canada. Hey, Ken, thank you for a Canadian perspective. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, thank you for having me, Tom. I was just seriously amused by you, all these guys wanting to come to Canada. First of all, we have single-payer health care insurance up here, which has been advertised many, many, many times, and I can't understand why people still want to come here when they're opposed to Obamacare.
I think they don't know that you have that. These are low information people. They watch Fox News and they don't know that anybody anywhere in the world has universal health care, single payer health care. They just know that it's wrong. But they don't know that Canada has.
I watch Fox News too, but it's only for amusement. Maybe that's my problem there.
Yeah.
But we are allowed gay and lesbian lovers to marry in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Our federal government controls more, not less. And personally, if you want to export all your crackers to Nunavut, which is fine. By the way, Tom, it's a territory, not a province yet.
Right. It's not a province.
No, sir,
I thought the Northwest Territories was split in half, and part was still the Northwest.
It is, but there's none of Northwest Territories, Yukon and Nunavut, which are still territories.
Uh-huh.
They'll be provinces eventually, especially if they start finding oil up there.
Yeah.
As global warming increases. But if you want to send them somewhere, I would suggest more likely place would be Greenland, where it's isolated and they can actually live in their own little bubble, to quote
Yeah, although the Greenlanders probably wouldn't like that. I mean, there are a few of them who live there. This is one of the problems. I mean, where do you find
tolerant. You got to admit, Danes are pretty tolerant.
Yeah, that's right. Greenland is a Danish colony, or a protectorate, or whatever it is. Maybe what we need to be looking at, since these, you know, one of these right wingers, Art Robinson, ran against, Peter DeFazio, one of the more progressive members of the House of Representatives from Oregon, and Art Robinson, in fact, two cycles in a row, and Robinson had come up with this brilliant idea that long-term exposure to low levels of radiation is actually good for you, and therefore the solution to our nuclear waste problem in the United States is to turn our nuclear waste into housing insulation and put it in everybody's walls, and it'll slowly generate a little bit of heat as it decays, plus, you know, we'd get the benefits of the radiation. Maybe we should simply take, you know, I mean, if we're looking for unoccupied territory, we've got the old nuclear test sites in Nevada that are pretty sterile. You got some islands in the South Pacific that are pretty sterile. Maybe. I don't know. It's where do you find a place where you're not bumping up against somebody who's already there? You know, it's a tough one.
Well, here in Saskatchewan, we export a lot of uranium. And in fact, this is one of our principal resources, that potash and heavy, regrettably heavy oil, which we're opening up more and more under our increasingly right-wing premier here.
Yep.
But I guess what really bothers me is the fact that I'm not anti-nuclear. I would say that nuclear energy has its place, providing it's put, the plants are put in safer places than on the shore of islands that are open to tsunamis. Mm-hmm. And so Saskatchewan would be almost an ideal place for that. But the other thing that bothers me, I guess, and I give some of your other listeners an opportunity to get in on this later, is the fact, just one comment here before I hang up, is that from my perspective, I have never been so glad in my entire life. And you have to understand that I'm going back from when Goldwater was running, that I have never been so glad to see a president elected to the United States. I do not understand why it is so hard for people in the United States to understand that this man is our one hope for world peace.
Yeah.
I do not understand that. I listened to Governor Romney. I listened to his shuffling back and forth on one side of the issue to the other. I was absolutely appalled. His policies made no sense. And I guess the one that really bothered me the most was the fact that his oil policy, energy independence.
North American energy independence, he says, which means bring more of that Canadian tar sands oil down.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's the point. Yeah. And that, I think that's what got me the most.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Ken, I got to move along. I got a whole bunch of people who want to get in on this conversation. Pardon me for being peremptory here, but thank you very much for the call. It's very nice to get a Canadian perspective and much appreciated. Sanchez in Long Beach, California. Hey, Sanchez, what's
up? How are you doing, Senor Hartman? As always, I wish you a very good day.
Thank you.
I'm calling, did you get a chance to read the Texas petition at all?
I have pieces of it. I have not read the thing in its entirety, but I did read a piece of it on the air just a few minutes ago.
Okay, yeah, it's. Do you mind if I read it? It's four very, very quick sentences, because I actually agree with everything that's written here.
Okay.
It says, and I quote, "The U.S. continues to suffer economic difficulties stemming from the federal government's neglect to reform domestic and foreign spending. The citizens of the U.S. suffer from blatant abuses of their rights, such as the NDAA, the TSA, et cetera, et cetera."
Right.
"Given that the state of Texas maintains a balanced budget and is the 15th largest economy in the world, it is practically feasible for Texas to withdraw from the union, and to do so would protect its citizen standards."
No, I got it. But this, all those are reasons to get more involved in federal politics, not to run away from them. If you don't like the NDAA, do something about it.
I'm a member of Occupy Los Angeles, and one of those little clauses in the NDA was written specifically for us. So we fight that whenever we can.
Right.
You know, I'm not just a couch.
So are you suggesting that the solution is for states to withdraw from the union? It seems to me that
no. You know what I'm saying is I understand the frustrations because I share the very same frustrations.
Okay. So all right. Sanchez, I got your point. Thank you very much. John in Warren, Ohio. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's great to talk to you. Congratulations. All your hard work paid off on this re-election. I just thank you so much. And my question to you is, do you have to be a resident of those states trying to secede to sign a petition, or can I sign every single one of those petitions?
That's a very good question. John, I genuinely don't know the answer to that, and but it may well be that you could. I just don't know. John, thanks a lot for the call. Cindy in Water Valette, Michigan.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the secession thing, and from this perspective, mm-hmm. if they decide to leave as whole states, then they have to pay before they can leave, because our federal taxes, everybody who paid in, the whole country, has maintained their roads in those states, their universities, their national parks, et cetera, their commons.
Right. And provided for their common defense.
Right.
For years and
so
years.
There's a certain amount of their taxes that went to their own facilities, and some of their taxes in those states were used in other states. But somehow or another, we would settle up, and probably they would owe us a lot more money to leave. They don't understand how much we have all paid in to yeah. their states.
Yeah, and Steve I.M. in our chat room says, if the former slave states want to put secession on the table, African Americans should insist that reparations be put on the table, too. The American South is built on the broken bodies and broken spirits of African slaves. If the bigots in Texas and Louisiana want to secede from the Union, I say good riddance to them, but there is a huge blood debt that needs to be paid before they go. Interesting. Cindy, thank you very much for the call. Yes, pay your bill. Jack in Newport News, Virginia. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I am absolutely flabbergasted by this. And in support of the word discourse, I really don't want to be mean, but when I first read this, I had to ask myself, I mean, what college dropout even came up with this idea? And the reason I say that is because...
Well, might be a high school dropout.
Possibly. There is, I think a cop, well, yeah. What do they think that would come if for some reason that the United States of America was not extremely butthurt by Texas leaving, which we would be. We would take it as an insult, a slap in the face, and I can guarantee you, all of our military bases are coming out of there. Every bit of money that ever went in there would stop.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they're the 15th largest economy in the world, and I don't even know where they got that number at, because the fact is a lot of that's built on national businesses coming in there and the money that the federal government state
sure.
puts in there, the military bases that are there. I just think that if they were to do this, that they would instantly become a third world country that could not get their crap together, because guess what? We probably wouldn't let them sell their oil either.
Right. Yeah, time to start putting up embargoes or tariffs, rather.
This is
the problem. Every effort to create a libertarian utopia has always turned into a dystopia. There has never been a successful libertarian country in the history of the world. And just like on a large scale, there's never been a successful communist country. It's like these two polar extremes. Neither one of them works, except maybe at the very smallest level. And I don't think libertarianism works at the local commune level at all. So I just don't think it works, period. But excellent point, Jack. Thanks a lot for calling and making it 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. You want to secede from the Union? That's sort of a variation of the old John Lennon song.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Say you want to have a Revo Secession? We'll be back.
Baby, take off your coat. Real slow.
Oh, yeah, that's our full modular music.
Baby, take off your shoes.
Oh, yeah, here's your shoes. Okay, here's our full Monty for the day, our full Monty alert for the day. Derek Belcher. That's an interesting last name. Anyhow, Derek Belcher is the owner, he's 45, he's the owner of a topless car wash in Alabama. And he has signed the petition for Alabama to secede from the Union, from the United States. Which raises the question, how are you going to run a topless car wash in Nineveh, Canada? You know, up on the Arctic, on the coast of the Arctic Ocean. I think it's going to be kind of tough. So, what'd you say, Louise? Retraining. Yes, a great retraining opportunity.
Denny in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Denny, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, we miss you in Portland, Tom.
Yeah, well, I'm still available. I just not out.
Hey, they can always work.
Yeah. So yeah, what's on your mind, Denny?
Hey, they can always wash the snowmobiles there.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, no Fox News up in Canada. I guess they didn't do their homework.
How so?
Well, there's no Fox News up there because they deemed it that they don't tell the truth.
Hate speech, yeah. Although I think that they've let them in now, but it was an interesting time. Denny, thanks a lot for the call. Jack in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Jack, what's up?
I wanted to talk to you about a robocall I got this morning.
Mm-hmm.
For impeach Obama now.
Oh, my. I told you before the election this was going to start. And, in fact, that what Daryl Issa was doing with Fast and Furious and Benghazi and all this other stuff is he was laying the groundwork for they're going to start attaching the word gate to the end of it. It's going to be Benghazi gate. Just watch. That'll be the next thing that pops up on Fox News. They saw it happen to Richard Nixon, and Nixon actually deserved it. And they have been looking to, and every president ever since Richard Nixon, there's been, you know, in their second term, which I guess is Bill Clinton, there's been this effort to impeach them. And there will be an effort to impeach Barack Obama, you know, just count on it. What did the robocall say, Jack?
Well, it had a long dissertation about he may not be a citizen and other stuff like that.
Yeah.
But okay. The most interesting thing I found about it was the same phone number that was running out met robocalls a couple weeks ago to defeat Obama Now.
Oh, interesting. So defeat Obama Now has become impeach Obama Now.
Right. And if
Amazing.
You call them back on their phone, they identify themselves as the Conservative Majority Fund.
Oh, another one of these groups that's taking money from the right-wing billionaires.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Jack, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the heads up. It's much appreciated. Forrest in Rusk, Texas. Hey, Forrest, what's on your mind?
Well, I want to talk about this Texas secession talk, please. I'm a Texas Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Okay.
We don't all support.
I know, and that's why I said, you know, it's not fair to the good progressives like you, Forrest, who are living in red states, to say, you know, let them go. Instead, you know,
red state because Texas right now is about 60-40 Republican to Democrat.
Right.
I fully expect us to be a full swing in play state in about. Oh, let's say about 4 years.
Yep.
And in 8 years, I really expect us, believe it or not, to be a Democrat-controlled state, a blue state, in maybe 6 years.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Exactly. We're growing. We are growing.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And it's because Americans are getting, and getting very clearly, I think, by the Republicans running a billionaire like Mitt Romney, you know, who made his living offshoring jobs and firing people. People are getting it that the Republican Party is the party of the billionaires, and the Democratic Party is the party of the working people, and working people are starting to wake up. Solid on you. Good on you, Forrest. Solid point. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what's going on?
I'm here.
Well, I'd like to talk about succession.
Yeah.
It'd be horrible. For one, they would roll back all kinds of environmental regulations, and we would make global warming worse.
Plus, we would have to breathe their air. It does move around.
Yeah. And they'd poison the Gulf of Mexico, because a lot of Gulf states would probably succeed.
Right.
And then they'd be poisoning the Gulf. The Gulf is a world treasure.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
We can't. These people don't believe in global warming, Tom.
Yeah, you're right.
They deserve a country to themselves.
Yeah.
If they want to leave the country, that'd be great. We should send a national program and send them all to Mars.
Yeah.
Mars!
Finally, yes, and Newt Gingrich suggested that. Finally, we have identified a place where there are not already human beings, who would be displaced. Nelson, and thanks a lot for that call. Nelson in Shamokin, Pennsylvania. Hey, Nelson, what's up?
Good afternoon, Mr. Harmon. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
When I first heard about this secession, I couldn't believe my eyes or my ears.
Mm-hmm.
President Lincoln, may God bless and rest his soul, said, "A house divided cannot stand." Have those people totally lost their minds?
Yes.
That's high treason.
Yes. Yeah, at least by the standards of Lincoln, yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hartman. I'm a conservative buyer. I voted for Obama because I love my country.
Yeah.
I'm not on the side of those lunatics and robber barons.
Okay. Well said. Nelson, thank you for the call, and thank you for your sharing your perspective with us. Ray in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Ray, we have a minute to wrap this hour up.
Okay, real quick then. What all these things are is a symptom of something much bigger that's going on in this problem. I've spent a lifetime teaching people how not to disturb themselves, so I know the mechanisms. I have to know the mechanism by which they do that. And what I know is for years now, these right-wing talkers have been using those same mechanisms to encourage people to disturb themselves needlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where they plug into these fight-or-flight mechanisms.
Yeah.
The formula for anxiety is catastrophize. And if you listen to Limbaugh and all these guys, what they do is they give all these people these possible but highly unlikely scenarios, and then they frame them in ways that seem awful to Americans, like socialism, communism, and loss of liberty. And these people are basing all their emotional disturbance on imagined events rather than reality.
Right.
On what they think Obama has done instead of what he's actually done.
Yeah, this is the conservative entertainment complex that is creating a national psychosis. Excellent point, Ray. Thank you for the call. And, yeah, excellent point. Coming up next, Mike Slater is going to drop by. Small business, he says, small business is going to be destroyed by Obama. Maybe he wants to leave the country. We'll find out. Host of Conservative Talk Show in San Diego. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike Slater on the line with us. He is a conservative talk show host on The Mike Slater Show, 6 to 9 a.m. weekdays on 760 KFMB in San Diego. Website 760KFMB.com. And Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just fine. I understand you guys are really concerned about small businesses under President Obama. Do I have that right?
Well, I'm concerned about all businesses, all people, sure.
Well, actually, let me ask you another question first. I am seeing all over the conservative blogosphere all this talk about secession, about leaving the union, and there's all these rumors that Nunavut, one of the territories, northern territories of Canada, has offered conservatives in the United States who want to come up there 40 acres and a snowmobile. What do you think?
I think Canada is quickly becoming the land of freedom in North America.
Is that because they have the national health care system?
No, they're lowering their taxes and they're embracing free trade in particular, I think, are two things that are really appealing about Canada lately.
Yeah, okay. But they have a national health care system, and they allow gay marriage, and their taxes are, 50-60% tax range for wealthy people in Canada.
It's a shame. There's becoming fewer and fewer places where people who embrace freedom can turn to.
I see. So where would you go? Somalia?
No, I'm going to stay here where I am in San Diego.
And Somalia is a libertarian paradise.
Oh,
it's exactly
sure.
What Ron Paul would want.
No,
very weak
not,
government.
No.
All the government does is national defense and run the police force. That's it.
No.
There's no food stamps.
That's ridiculous.
There's no welfare. There's no, welfare queens driving Cadillacs. None of that in Somalia.
There's also no rule of law, which is the proper function.
Actually, there is. There's a constitution. There are laws. There are police to enforce those laws. There are courts. Somalia does have a functioning court system. It just doesn't have anything else.
Is this the conversation we're having today? I thought we were talking about...
Okay, let's talk about small businesses.
We're going to justify Somalia as a conservative paradise.
Well, I think Somalia is what happens when libertarians run things. But in any case, you're suggesting that President Obama being reelected is going to be bad for small businesses. I'm looking at these stats that show that average small business growth during the Clinton years, August 1993 to March 2001, 2.3% growth. And these are actual real small businesses, 20 to 500 employees, as opposed to, people like the Koch brothers having a pass through and calling it a small business or Paul Singer having a pass through and just running billions of dollars through it and calling it a small business. During the Bush administration, the last Republican administration, it wasn't 2.3% like it was during Clinton. It was only 1%. And that only goes through December 2007 so that those numbers are not contaminated by the great crash.
Okay. So,
So what makes you think? What makes you think that? I mean, historically, if you look at the last 100 years in the United States, stock markets go up more under Democrats than they do under Republicans. Wages for working people go up more under Democrats than they do under Republican administrations. The only thing that goes up more under Republican administrations than Democratic administrations over the last 100 years is the wealth of the super rich and the poverty of the poor.
What about the last 4 years, Tom?
Well, the wealth of the super rich has been increasing, but not anywhere near as rapidly as it was during the George W. Bush administration. And the poverty of the poor, we've been catching them with food stamps and unemployment benefits. Now, I know Republicans want to do away with those things, but...
I guess the reason I know your listeners are like, oh my gosh, Tom Hartman's destroying them. The reason I'm having trouble even having a conversation with you as usual is it always has to be Democrat-Republican. It always has to be rich-poor. Let's have a conversation about... like about principles, about real issues here. Not just the Democrats.
That's fine. You lead it.
Republicans. This is ridiculous.
Okay. Give me a frame that you want to debate in, and I'll debate you in it.
Because Republicans under George Bush spent tons of money, spent so much money, it's ridiculous. So I'm not going to sit here and defend Republicans like you defend the left just for the sake of party labels. So I'm not going to have that conversation, Tom. I can't even relate on your level.
Okay, that's fine. Similarly, I won't. I would not defend Democrats for things like the NDAA. But setting that aside, let's talk. You want to talk principles? Let's talk principles. What makes you think, if you look at the history of the United States, or you look at the history of any of the OECD nations, the 34, 38 most developed nations in the world over the last 100 years, what makes you think that having an austerity-driven budget, basically, a conservative budget, is going to be better than having a democratic socialist, a very liberal budget, when it's the democratic socialist nations right now that are doing very well, thank you very much, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Denmark, they're all doing great. They all have low unemployment.
I believe that in America, people can spend and invest the money that they earn more wisely than a centralized bureaucratic government out of D.C.
I don't disagree with that.
Moving forward.
I've got some money in savings. I don't want the government investing it for me. I'll invest it and lose it myself.
I've done more often than not. So I think moving any direction we can move closer to the Constitution, where the federal government has a limited role and states have a more sovereign and a powerful role, then I think we're moving in the right direction. And right now,
well, wait a minute. Why?
The government is spending.
Why?
More than
first of all, the founders did not envision a limited federal government. Alexander Hamilton. This is Alexander Hamilton, December 5th, 1791. He's the Secretary of the Treasury in the George Washington administration. He was there in the room when the Constitution was written. In fact, he gave one of the more famous speeches about it. He signed it. He literally one of the founders. He said, and I quote, "The terms general welfare were doubtless intended to signify more than was expressed or imported in those which preceded. Otherwise, numerous exigencies incident to the affairs of the nation would have been left out without a provision. It is not fit that the constitutional authority of the Union to appropriate its revenues should have been restricted within narrower limits than the general welfare, because this necessarily embraces a vast variety of particulars which are subject neither of specification nor of definition. It is therefore of necessity left to the discretion of the national legislature to pronounce upon the objects which concern the general welfare and for which, under that description, an appropriation of money is requisite and proper." End of quote. The first paragraph of Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which is the enumerated powers of conservatives tend to refer to as the enumerated powers. The phrase does not appear in the Constitution, but the powers of Congress. The first paragraph, the first sentence talks about, Congress has the power to appropriate and spend money to promote the general welfare. The last sentence basically says the same thing all over again. How is providing people with unemployment benefits at the federal level unconstitutional?
Oh my gosh, so much going on there. First of all, that quote right there and the opinions of Hamilton were resoundingly defeated by the rest of the founding fathers.
No, they were not. They ratified the Constitution. Hamilton was one of the guys who was selling it in the Federalist Papers.
Can't just quote one founding father. What was the final result of enumerates of all the founding fathers. But that's not the point I want to make right here.
Okay, well let me cite one founding father's action then. You know who was the first president to propose and then sign into law legislation providing for housing, medical care, and food for poor and indigent people?
Who?
George Washington.
But based off of the federal government?
Yes.
The federal
government. It was a poorhouse in Washington, D.C., yes.
D.C. would have been the nation's capital then, right, which would have been different because that would have been the District of Columbia, which is different than all the states. So let me ask you this question. This is a very simple question. Are you out of New York, Tom?
Am I what?
Are you in New York?
No, I'm in D.C. right now.
You're in D.C. So what is the poorest neighborhood in San Diego?
I don't have a clue.
Exactly. And I don't know what the poorest neighborhood in D.C. is. So what makes anyone think that D.C. bureaucrats know what's best for the people of San Diego? I know what's I and my local representatives have firsthand knowledge.
Broadly, Mike, I agree with you on that. I agree with you that you know, whenever possible, power should be centralized locally. But there are some things that are so big, like, you know, multi-million dollar illnesses, people getting leukemia, needing bone marrow transplants and things, that it would break a local. But in any case, Mike Slater, you can read all about it, 760KFMB.com. Mike, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of your thoughts and my thoughts on this. It's a session, really? Right after this, 15 minutes past it. Time for a crazy alert. There's a whole new meaning to doing the robot. According to an article on transhumanity.net, a futurist website, robot lovers of the future may have the potential to extend human lifespans by providing their human partners with mind-blowing sexual gratification that humans simply aren't capable of providing. The article claims that robot lovers will be able to provide their partners with longevity orgasms that are not only far superior to what humans can produce, but are also good for your mental and physical well-being and will help you live longer. There's actually some evidence to back up these claims. Multiple studies have shown that women who had a higher frequency of orgasms during sex lived longer than those who didn't. Of course, sex bots are still many years away from becoming reality, but some researchers suggest the rise of these things could come, sex bots and robotic prostitutes, as soon as 2050. So if you want to live longer and don't mind sleeping with a cold, rough metal robot, then maybe it's time to start saving up for the sex bot of your dreams. Yeah, I don't know. Mo in New York City. And hey, Mo, what's up? Mo, I can't hear you. I can't. It's all badly distorted. I'm going to put you on hold, and they will check your call. Maybe it's you. Maybe it's us. We'll find out. Jerry in McKinney, Texas. Hey, Jerry. What's up? Mo is on line one,
really,
by the way, or on line three to tell Louise and Danielle. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hey, I was really hoping to hear your guest talk about how President Obama is going to destroy small business. I'm a small businessman here in the Dallas area.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people that are literally panicked and holding on to their money and everything else. I mean, this was a huge Romney-supported area.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't heard anybody tell me how President Obama is going to destroy my life, because my life has actually gotten better in the last couple of years compared to where it was after the crash. I mean,
yeah.
When is the sky going to fall?
It's not. I do think that there's a very real possibility that there will be an economic crash in the next few years. I think that we are still in the great Bush crash of 2006, and it started in 2006. That was when the Case-Shiller Index, the home inventory and the home sales really started dropping precipitously. That was the busting of the housing bubble, and which set up the busting in the stock market bubble 2 years later, just like the same thing happened in 1927, 29. And Obama, to his credit, stepped in immediately, whereas in 1929 we had to wait 3 years for Franklin Roosevelt to get elected and step in. So we had 3 years of, Republican basically do nothing, which is, of course, what they recommend doing. Romney was basically, you know, liquidate it all, just like Secretary Mellon was saying back during the administration in 1929 of Herbert Hoover. So I don't know. We'll see where this goes, but
For me right now, perception is reality, and I'm in the construction business, and if the wealthy are paranoid, I hope they get over it soon, because I didn't vote for Romney because of his immigration stances and that sort of thing.
Well, I think
I really don't understand how people from Texas, or North Texas, not Austin and places like that, can be so afraid.
Well, because they listen to the conservative entertainment complex. They listen to the right-wing talk shows. They watch Fox News, and those people have nothing to sell but fear. And so people get really jacked up on fear. I mean, there was a piece on DU, and somebody was posting about it also on our message boards over at TomHartman.com the other day about this person was talking about how they literally got a call from a member of their family when the election was called, sobbing, going, this is it, it's over. We've it's like almost suicidal. I mean, the country's coming to an end. No, sorry, the country's not coming to an end. And Obama's not coming to get your guns, So, Jerry, thank you for the call. I think you're right. Chris in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Chris, thanks for listening to TuneIn Radio. What's up?
All right, hold on, Tom. Hello?
Yeah, thank you for taking it off speakerphone. What's
cool.
up?
Hey, long-time listener. I've lived in Portland way back when Bush, I'll be nice, was considered being nominated.
Hmm.
And with you, I guess I'm on the faculty of the Tom Hartman U.
Okay.
And UAW, retired and surfed for all my life. So, anywho.
So, what's up, Chris?
Yes, this is cool. My first statement is, what do you think, let's take a imaginary state that wants to secede.
Mm-hmm.
And they get 25,000 voters. I think that those 25,000 voters might be in danger, to use like a Southern strategy, they might be in danger of becoming lynched by, let's say, the other 25 million that live in the state.
Well, let's not use that. Let's not use that word. It's got a horrible,
I'm sorry, but I mean, just as a visual.
Yeah.
And then if that was to happen, it's never going to happen. It would be the end of federal assistance would be appropriate, military presence, spending, and industry.
Right.
And to end it, I know there's a lot. History says, through history, actual events, the greatest threat, let's just say, to the USA now, but in terms of history, has always been from within.
Not always. In 1812, the Canadians and the Brits actually marched to D.C. and burned the White House.
I know. So. But we're strong as Americans, and that's across the board.
Yeah.
So I'm being nice now as opposed to the rude term earlier.
Yeah.
But if you look at history, what destroyed Rome, and I'll let you fill in the blanks,
mm-hmm.
to use your terminology, has been from within. I mean, it's destroyed, failed governments, collapsed societies.
I would submit to you that it has been corruption from within. It has been a small number of wealthy and obsessive people basically taking control of government to their own ends so that they can make themselves richer and richer and richer. And it impoverishes and destroys the republic that it was within. And in fact, I would argue that Socrates was part of something very much like that when he supported the revolution of, Revolution of the 400 and the Revolution of the 40s.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think it was E.F. Stone wrote a really interesting book about that, that he wasn't quite the nobleman that he was when he drank the hemlock that he was made out to be. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I just this whole thing about General Petraeus and now General Allen and the women that they love and their wives and their apparently some weird FBI agent who was sending naked picture of chest naked chest pictures of himself to this Allen woman, or to this Kelly woman, who was then, who then he, the FBI agent, then decided to investigate what was going on with her emails from Paula Broadwell, who then he dug into her emails, and then in doing so, he discovered all these emails from Petraeus. And here's what I find interesting about this. The ability of an individual FBI agent to do this kind of snooping was brought to us by George Bush, courtesy of 9/11, as part of the whole be afraid, be very afraid, give all these snooping powers to government. And now it is biting them in the butt. I think this should be a cautionary tale for all of us. If you want a national surveillance state, then you know, as so many of these hawks do, and as so many of these Republicans do, if you want a national security state, then you better damn well be squeaky clean. Jack in LaGrange, Illinois. Hey, Jack, it says here you disagree with me. Go to the front of the line. What's up?
I just like to talk about, I want to move to a different topic, actually, and the corruption of the Obama administration and who is leading in these financial policies he put into place. Now, Mr. Hartman, if you look at who led the $775 billion stimulus package that Mr. Obama passed, it was John Corzine.
No, it wasn't. It was Jared Bernstein. He wrote it. I know Jared Bernstein. He wrote it.
I know. But Joe Biden publicly stated the first person they asked for financial advice from, and you can look on YouTube, was John Corzine. He publicly stated that.
I say that John Corzine, I don't know anything about that. B, John Corzine's a crook. And
well, can you?
So, but what does that have to do with anything? Sometimes crooks have good ideas.
Nice crooks have good ideas, but this.
No, sometimes crooks do have good ideas. The fact of the matter is that wasn't John Corzine wasn't the force behind the thing that stopped us. By the way, have you, Jack, bothered to go look at the actual charts and graphs that show the loss of jobs and show the point at which the stimulus kicked in?
Well, I know his predictions were false.
What actually happened was that we were losing 800,000 jobs a month when Obama came into office. It got actually worse for a couple of months, and then the stimulus kicked in, and all of a sudden that job loss turned around. It went from 800,000 to 400,000 to 200,000 a month, and then it went to zero, and then we started making 30,000 jobs a month, and then we started making 90,000 jobs a month, and then for 40 straight months, we were making jobs. I mean, we created over 4 million jobs in this country, and you can literally, if you look at the month-by-month graph of job creation in the United States, and you superimpose on that point in time when the stimulus bill went into effect, that was the point at which the whole thing turned. And you cannot deny that. It is a simple fact. And until somebody comes along and says, oh, here's the other big factor that caused it to turn at that point, I'm going to say it's the stimulus, because I know of nothing else that happened in that month. I believe it was May. It might have been April of 2009, when suddenly we stopped increasing the number of jobs we were losing and started decreasing the number of jobs we were losing and moving very quickly toward creating jobs every month. Do you know of any event other than the stimulus bill that did that? Jack? And Jack's still on the board, but he's being very quiet. Okay. Let's try Patrick in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Patrick, how you doing? Oh, the internet. Oh, our phone's croaked. Oh my. Okay. In that case, I will close this. I will close this software, and Oh yeah, our internet really did crash. It kicked me out of the chat room as well. So let me go back to my riff about, if I may, back to my riff about. In fact, the internet is apparently still down. Let me go back to my riff about General Petraeus getting entangled in this national security machine that frankly should never have been, right? As the Associated Press reports, the downfall of CIA director, this is the AP, and this I'm verbatim from an AP report, Common Dream staff aggregated a lot of these reports over at commondreams.org, and it's really a good read. The downfall of CIA Director David Petraeus demonstrates how easy it is for federal law enforcement agents to examine emails and computer records. I mean, this is not rocket science. This is not difficult any longer. And so, with that in mind, I think it's incumbent on all of us to be asking the question, you know, is this national security state really serving us? Is this really what we want in this country? I think not. Dave Lindorf, the independent journalist, he says, what makes the epic collapse of this consummate political general's career so exquisite is that it was the post-9/11 spying capabilities of the FBI that allowed its agents to slip unannounced into the email of the general's paramour, Paula Broadwell. He adds, a name that could have been selected by Ian Fleming. Yes, Broadwell. Glenn Greenwald. He says, writing for The Guardian, the British newspaper, Glenn Greenwald says, what is most striking is how sweeping, probing, and invasive the FBI's investigation then became, all without any evidence of any actual crime or the need for a search warrant. Glenn Greenwald continues. He says, this is a surveillance state run amok. As Trevor Tim at the Electronic Freedom Foundation put it this morning, who knew the key to stopping the surveillance state was just to wait until it got so big that it ate itself? Now, that's where the interesting question comes in. Are we going to see, as a consequence of this whole thing with Petraeus, are we going to see people, you know, you got one apparently loony FBI agent sending pictures of his naked chest to this woman, this Kelly woman. And then he decides to investigate her email, and then that leads him to Paula Broadwell's email, and that leads him to General Petraeus's email. And so you got an FBI agent gone rogue, apparently. And in fact, he apparently leaked this to Eric Cantor months ago or weeks ago in the hopes that the Republicans could use it to trash President Obama, because according to his worldview, and this is something I find, you know, very interesting that they actually, I think it was the New York Times used that phrase, you know, according to this FBI agent's worldview, the reason why he was having trouble actually getting into these email accounts and he was able to, you know, follow through all the, was that the president was covering something up. So let's pass it along to Eric Cantor and hope that Eric Cantor will tell Rush Limbaugh about it. Well, Eric Cantor didn't even bother to tell the head of the Intelligence Committee in the House of Representatives or the head of the Intelligence Committee in the United States Senate, Dianne Feinstein. I mean, on national television, she's like yesterday, oh, this is the first I've heard of this, you know, with some of the details. So the national security state, is it making us safer? Do you feel safer? Yeah, on the one hand, I suppose, you know, we haven't been attacked by terrorists in quite some time. But on the other hand, you know, hey, is this really, really the kind of nation that we want to be living in, where everything, this used to be the province of conservatives. It used to be that conservatives are the ones who were constantly warning us about when government gets too big and starts, you know, Big Brother starts looking over your shoulder. There was a time when that was the conservative worldview, and with some justification, frankly. And now it's like so many conservatives are just, you know, gung-ho. Oh, yeah, you know, it's a 9/11. We got to stop the terrorists. You know, let them look into anybody's email. Except mine. I mean, this is a symptom of what happens when people who are small and frightened, the Dick Cheneys of the world, the George Bushes of the world, the Alberto Gonzalez's of the world, the Condoleezza Rice's of the world, the Jay Bibee and John Hughes of the world, what happens when people like that are actually making policy? They start torturing people. They start killing people. They start wars. They destroy people's lives. And they put into place policies and procedures that allow the government, the only agency to which we entrust the power to actually put us to death, to take away our freedom. The only entity within the United States that we give that power to, they allow the government to further encroach in our rights and our powers and our rights and our privacy. And they do so in the name of conservatism. We've got to get John Dean back on one of these days, talking about, you know, the crazy conservatives. Anyhow, we'll be back with more right after this. 45 minutes past the hour. Our phones are working now. Give us a shout. Actually, we're filling up as we speak.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be giving away a copy of Cracking the Code, my book on the history of Western democracy and all that kind of cool stuff, whenever Shane decides, yeah.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Ain't that news? Ain't that good news? Man, 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 ain't that news?
Yeah, ain't that news? Welcome back. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. And in the studio with us today, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And hey, well, there you are on that nice TV machine.
The Petraeus story gets more complicated.
Uh-huh.
And one is, I think BuzzFlash, one of those, believe that somehow Eric Cantor may have tried to bring this up as an October surprise. The evidence, I think, is kind of out on
that.
It
was certainly handed off to him with that hope, was it not?
Probably, yes. It was certainly, that I don't doubt. But the other question is, everybody's saying, why didn't the president know? Why didn't Eric Cantor, who's a big cheese, pick up the phone and say, Mr. President, this is what's going on. You need to know. I mean, if
that
he's a patriotic American, that's what I would have done.
Yes, that would be the patriotic thing to do.
Right.
Not
so that's number
Cantor.
One. Number two, General Allen and General Petraeus wrote a letter on behalf of Miss Kelly's sister, who was undergoing a custody case, it looks like, in the District of Columbia. So it wasn't like some Florida, you know, right-wing judge. And custody was taken away from her completely, saying that she was not a good mother, that she had mood disorders, etc. Both General Petraeus and General Kelly wrote letters to help her get custody. I mean, that is strange.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's like this kind of incestuous little circle. There's the group of apparently about three or four families that were boinking each other or whatever.
I don't know if you saw the email my brother Michael sent it to me today, and they're complaining about gays in the military.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, one of our stories today, Ryan is surprised at the election results.
Yes.
He said, I don't think we lost it on budget issues, and actually there was just a study done that, in fact, they did lose it on some budget issues.
Of course they did.
So that is what's quite amazing. There was a poll done, a post-poll done on Election Day.
Right.
In fact, they did lose it on budget issues. And he said he was surprised at the turnout in urban areas. Okay, he's in the what planet is he on department?
Well, or the he's a racist department. He's basically what Paul Ryan is saying is that people were voting race rather than issue. And
in fact, I just found the study. It was Hart Research. It was done for the AFL-CIO.
Mm-hmm.
And 52% of the voters said, this is what they said on the exit poll, we are sending the message that we should make sure the wealthy start paying their fair share of taxes. 62%.
Wow.
On the Hart poll.
And that's even more than the percentage by which Obama won.
That's
so
right.
If anything, some people who think that the wealthy should be paying more taxes, who disagreed with Paul Ryan on policy, still voted for him.
There is bipartisan support for ending preferential tax treatment for corporations that ship jobs overseas. 64% of all voters wanted to end those loopholes.
Amazing.
Which means you have the core of the Republican Party. That's it.
Right.
Also, by the way, the president today at the briefing through Jay Carney said that he was He's very highly, thinks very highly of Allen. However, Defense Secretary Panetta asked that it be a hold on his nomination to be NATO, Supreme NATO Commander in Afghanistan. So it looks like that's not going to happen until this is all sorted out.
Yeah, which only makes sense, actually.
Now, it just looks like if the White House gets a petition, they are required with 25,000 or more signatures, they're required to review it. Apparently, several states of the Tea Party people have sent in petitions.
Louisiana and Texas specifically.
Right.
Yes, I have the list here.
They want to withdraw from the union.
We actually had a secessionist on in our first hour.
Oh, you did?
Only he was a Vermont secessionist, and he was like, we want to secede for the right reasons, right? You know, we want to create like a Finland or a Norway. We want to create a little democratic socialist republic up here. And those guys want to secede for the wrong reasons. You know, they're a bunch of racist yahoos. So
the new Senator King from this will be the third king in Congress, I believe.
All unrelated.
But he has not decided who he's going to caucus with. It was rumored when he ran that he was going to caucus with the Democrats. He said it doesn't matter who he caucuses with at this point. He's going to be his own independent voice. So we'll see what happens on that front.
If he doesn't caucus with one of the two parties, he'll get a seat, but he won't get any appointments, right?
He won't get any committee appointments. That's right.
Right.
Exactly. So you got to caucus with somebody.
Right. Unless you want to genuinely just be a senator who's just, got your own voice and that's it. Hanging in the wind.
And then you might not get to run again.
Right.
Because
King started out as a Republican and then he became an independent, did he not?
I believe so. That's right.
And he's from Maine and,
And he was a governor and.
Right. And quite the curmudgeon.
Right. The Supreme Court has now rescheduled as to whether to hear Proposition 8. Originally, they were going to.
You're talking about Prop 8 in California?
That's right. This is the DOMA situation, right. The legality, the constitutionality of DOMA. So they were going to hear it on November 20th. Now it's not hearing. It's among the justices. Mm. If you need four justices to decide whether a case gets heard. If they decide not to hear it, it goes back to the lower court, which said that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional. And therefore, marriage would be legal in California.
And all that money the Mormon Church spent on getting Prop 8 through, it's... Yeah.
Mormon Church is a mixed bag because they apparently they pay partner benefits
for gay couples.
For anybody, for unmarried. And I know they've been doing a lot of work on the higher ups on with the Family Acceptance Project. I mean,
maybe they pay family benefits for people who are not married because if you have a second, third, or fourth wife, you don't actually marry them. You call them sister
wives. I love listening to you. You know what? I always hear an angle I haven't.
It would have to be that way.
Okay. United Nations on Tuesday, that's today, voted 188-3 that the embargo to Cuba should go away. Israel and Palau are the only countries that voted with us.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, that's something that's gonna one of those tipping points that has been reached too. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
It's always great having you here. Go to free-don.org and of course talkradionews.com for more information.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is a very, by the way, welcome back to the program. 6 minutes past the hour. One of the interesting things that Ellen Ratner reported in her last newscast was that Eric Cantor may have been trying for an October surprise. That's an interesting one. The last 100 years here in the United States, I just want to lay this out for you. The last 100 years have seen three hugely consequential presidencies, 8-year presidencies that defined and changed the nature and the face of the United States of America. First, there was the presidency of FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He saved us from the Republican Great Depression, successfully fought World War II. After him came the general who fought that war, or at least the European front, Dwight Eisenhower. And he not only continued Roosevelt's policies, But Eisenhower so massively increased federal government investments in America. And there's a big difference between spending and investment. Investment is stuff that produces returns, right? And Eisenhower understood this. You spend on a war. You know, the money goes out, it gets blown up or turned into bullets or bombs, and it's gone. You invest in a hospital. In fact, 80% of the cost of all new hospitals in the United States during the Eisenhower administration were paid for by the federal government. He built schools all across the country. He built the interstate highway system. He did that so much that much of the infrastructure that we use today was either built or started during Eisenhower's presidencies, during his presidency. These policies of Eisenhower's and the extension of FDR's, top tax rate 91%, reasonable well-enforced taxes on businesses. The consequence of that is that we were able to pay off that massive 127% of GDP debt that we'd run up fighting World War II. Roosevelt and Eisenhower lifted up the working class. They created the modern middle class. The rich did just fine, by the way, although their wealth did grow at about the same rate as everybody else's, around 3.2% per year. Everybody, rich people were getting richer, poor people were getting richer, middle class getting richer, everybody. The third really consequential presidency in the last 100 years was Ronald Reagan. And he began the complete reversal of the previous 50 years of highly successful progressive policies that had started with FDR. For the first time in history, for example, the Department of Labor was headed up by a man who hated unions. And the rights of working people came under such an unprecedented assault that union representation in America's private sector has gone from over 30% when Reagan came into office to around 8% today. Same thing happened. Actually, it was over 25% when Reagan. It was around 25%. The peak of 30% was hit during Harry Truman's presidency. The same thing happened with the Department of Education. And before Reagan, 80% of the cost of college educations nationwide were picked up by the federal government, and many colleges were free. You know, the University of California system. Today, there are no more free colleges, and only 20% of the cost of college education is picked up by the government, which is why you have $1 trillion in student debt right now. That's $1 trillion that would have been paid by the federal government. Reagan killed free college education in California as governor there and presided over the death of it nationwide as president. Reagan halted the growth and the maintenance of our infrastructure so completely that this infrastructure that Dwight Eisenhower, by and large, helped us build is now crumbling into third world status. Reagan destroyed the growth of small businesses by stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Act, leading to 30 years of mergers, acquisitions, and hostile takeovers. You know, before Ronald Reagan, every town and mall in America was filled with small, local businesses and looked different from every other town and mall. Today, as the king of Papa John's lives in his castle, literally a castle with a moat around it, a handful of companies own the stores and restaurants that populate most of our nation, and those small businesses are gone. The vulture capitalists like Romney and Milken, they got rich. The rest of us, especially the small businesses, business people among us, screwed. So those were the three big and consequential presidencies. Now here's a fourth, Barack Obama. If you think I'm exaggerating by putting Obama into that group, and by the way, I'm doing so based not on so much on what he's done, but what he could do, although he has done some really extraordinary things. If you think I'm exaggerating, listen to what conservative Bill Kristol had to say on Fox News.
I think Republicans will have to give in much more than they think. He won re-election. He's four presidents in the last century have won more than 50% of the vote twice. Roosevelt, Eisenhower, Reagan, and Obama. It pains me to say that, to put him in that with those other three, but it's a fact.
Yep. Obama is one of only four presidents in the last 100 years to get this sort of landslide mandate. And I'd say it's because people would very much like to go back to the policies of Democrat FDR and Republican Eisenhower rather than sticking with the Reaganomics revolution that we've been suffering under for the past 32 years. Americans are absolutely sick of seeing our country bled to death by giant and profitable transnational corporations, a quarter of which pay no income taxes whatsoever, even though they're showing profits. Americans are sick of seeing their kids graduating from college, owing so much debt to banksters they'll spend much of their lives paying it off. Americans are sick of seeing our jobs shipped overseas and our nation colonized by foreign corporations in search of raw materials and cheap labor. And Americans are sick of seeing us as the world's largest debtor, a trend that Ronald Reagan proudly kicked off, calling it the international free market and trickle-down economics. So Obama won by a larger percentage of the popular vote than Reagan did in 1980. Obama has a huge mandate, right up there with FDR, Eisenhower, and Reagan. But some Republicans haven't gotten the message. They think everything's wonderful, except for those pesky minorities and urban whites who live in the big cities. You know, the people who've seen their cities ravaged by Reaganomics. They've seen their jobs shipped overseas by so-called free trade. Who've seen their families slide into poverty as the rich have seen a more than 275% increase in income and wealth since Reaganomics began. But to Republicans, it's not about any of those things. It's just about race. Paul Ryan, for example, had this to say.
I don't think we lost it on those budget issues. I think people, especially on Medicare, we clearly didn't lose it on those issues. We knew this was going to be a close race. We thought we had a very good chance of winning it. I think the surprise was some of the turnout. Some of the turnout, in, especially in urban areas, which definitely gave President Obama the big margin to win this race.
Oh, it was those nasty urban areas. Now, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. You didn't lose it on the issues. And people in big cities turning out caused you to lose. But they weren't voting on issues? Why? Paul Ryan, is that because they're just, like, too dumb? Is that because they're just voting their race? Really? I mean, I remember during the presidency of Bill Clinton about the pastiest white guy you'll ever see, overwhelmingly the African-American community voted for him, and it wasn't because he was an African-American. Overwhelmingly white intellectuals, white progressives, white college students voted for him. And it wasn't because they were white and he was white. You know, yeah, there may be some voters for whom, you know, this or any other election is about race, but they're few and, you know, they really are the margins. Paul Ryan is trying to blame having lost the White House on Obama's race. And it's got nothing to do with it. And this is the lesson. If the Republicans don't learn this lesson soon, they really are toast. Because the country is changing. And yes, it's changing demographically, but along with that, it's changing psychographically. Nobody's talking about psychographics. Nobody's talking about the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times. Nobody's talking about the gestalt of America, the sense of who we are, and how important that was to this election.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Obama won because he said, let's bring us all together. Romney lost because he said he's going to cut taxes on the rich.
You go back, Jack, do it again. We'll turn it round and round. You go back, Jack, do it again.
Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we, the people of the United States of America. Matt in Lewisburg, North Carolina. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. How you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Not too bad. Good. Look, I'm a conservative here, and I'm very moderate, but I'm starting to see the light here.
What does conservative mean to you?
It means fiscally responsible.
Okay. What makes you think the liberals are not fiscally responsible?
If you listen to enough of the rhetoric on the conservative channels, that will pretty much propaganda.
No, I understand that, but if you look at the presidents that offer balanced budgets, they are Democrats, not Republicans. If you look at the Congresses that balance budgets, they tend to be Democratic, not Republicans. This whole thing of having wildly unbalanced budgets began with Ronald Reagan. You know, the whole two Santa Claus thing that Jude Winiski pushed forward.
Sure. Once again, I'm learning here. I'm learning every day.
All right.
I've only been politically tuned in probably for the last 8 or 10 years.
Yeah.
Just via Sirius satellite radio.
I think, my dad was a Republican until the day he died and always described himself as a conservative. And his kind of conservatism was the Dwight Eisenhower conservatism, William F. Buckley conservatism. And the essential definition of that, William F. Buckley famously said, a conservative is a man who stands astride the arc of history with his hand out shouting stop. And that was kind of my dad's worldview, was like, if it ain't fixed, don't broke. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. We shouldn't be messing with things. Let's take things slowly. Let's think things through. Let's not do anything, radical or quick. But it was not the kind of reactionary right wing craziness that I see on Fox. At all.
I understand completely. So. And you might notice I said conservative, not Republican.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Yeah,
so anyhow, the point that you wanted to make, Matt, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Not at all. Basically, I was just listening to you earlier here, and I'm not exactly a one-issue voter, but a big issue of mine has been the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And let me preface this just by saying that, I saw no attempt in any form at all of this administration over the last 4 years going after our guns.
Well, in fact, they did the opposite. Obama allows guns now into national parks and onto Amtrak.
Sure. No, and I see that, and that's great. It kind of shook my foundations a little bit to hear Hillary sneaking around out there trying to restart talks with the UN over this whole thing.
I don't know that that's true, Matt. I would ask you to prove that to me, because that would be political suicide. And in addition to just crazy talk, because the UN doesn't have any interest in our guns anyway.
Well, and once again, I've read a few things about it that were explaining it a little bit better. It's not looking to strip down all Americans. It's not looking to start an official gun registration. And I think the biggest problem that a lot of conservatives have, you'd be surprised how many single-issue voters, conservatives, are out there with the gun issue.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't be surprised. I grew up in Michigan. I know.
And I realize there's a lot of Democrats that love to shoot. I'm a shooter. I just like to shoot. I have a range in my backyard. I shoot.
My brother has a range in his backyard. Whenever Louise and I go back to Michigan, that's what we do. Is Steve and Tam and Louise and I we got some great pictures of Louise standing there holding Steve's 45 in her hand. He's got a 9mm. He's got a great Glock. He's got a really nice 22 target pistol. Anyhow, back to you.
Well, no, you made mention, and it made me feel good. I've been kind of spying in on you guys here over the last week or so here, and you're not as bad as I'd heard.
Okay, well, that's reassuring.
and I mean that sincerely.
Thank you.
I have been thoroughly propagandized, if that's even a word.
Yeah, it is.
And I'm trying to reprogram myself here a little bit, because, if you listen to anything enough, I think Mitt said that in the debates, sooner or later you do start to take it as fact.
Sure, in fact, we've got Franklin Roosevelt talking about that, about a fellow who wrote a book that said that. The book was Mein Kampf. I'll play that clip for you in a minute, but anyhow, Matt, you wanted to say.
Yeah, and I basically just wanted to say is that, your opinion here is what is going to go on over the next 4 years with the guns here.
I think first of all, one of the things you should know is, who is the most liberal senator in the United States Senate, the most progressive, wild socialist? Who is it?
Well, I just heard he had an A+ rating with the NRA the other day. So would this be Dirty Harry by any chance?
No, Bernie Sanders. But Harry Reid also has an A+ rating with the NRA. Bernie Sanders is from Vermont. There's no gun laws in Vermont. You can walk into a gun shop, buy a gun, stick it in your pants as a concealed weapon, and walk out.
That thoroughly just blows my mind. I'm in North Carolina, born and bred, raised in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And then moved down here 20 years later. I've been here for 20 years.
Yeah. Massachusetts is a whole lot different from Vermont when it comes to guns. But here's what I think is going to happen. I think that there is about a 10 or 20% chance that the assault weapons ban, which, by the way, was promoted by George Herbert Walker Bush. This was a Republican initiative.
Yes, sir.
That the assault weapons ban might be resurrected and passed. I do think, however, though, there's been so much demagoguery around guns that the Obama administration will probably just keep their fingers off anything. But if they do anything, that would be it, and that would be all they would do. And I think that that's actually a reasonable thing.
And most of us, as long as we're not talking confiscation here, most of us have no problem with that.
Right. I know. And it was the law of the land for a long time. I mean, it just expired a few years ago, and it didn't seem to cause any disruption. People could still
I'll tell you this. In the interest of healing these scars and this divide and all these things that you see, I think that your side would be very well served to get that message out there.
Well, we've been trying to. I debate guns and talk to gun aficionados, and again, I put myself in that category. I'm not a hunter, but I'm a target shooter. Regularly on this program and talk about the origins of the Second Amendment in the Pennsylvania Constitution, which I think you would find fascinating. It was really all about not having a standing army during times of peace. But Matt, I'm going to put you on hold because Shane says you want a copy of my book, Cracking the Code, about the history of liberalism and conservatism.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
866-987-THOM. So Matt has won the book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. I hope he finds it interesting. It'd be fascinating to have a conservative read it and call back. That would be the good, the bad, and the very, very quintessentially ugly. The good, Tesla. Remember the first presidential debate when Mitt Romney called electric car company Tesla a loser? Here's a refresher.
But don't forget, you put $90 billion, like 50 years worth of breaks, into solar and wind, to Solyndra and Fisker and Tesla and EnterOne. I mean, I had a friend who said you don't just pick the winners and losers, you pick the losers.
Well, it looks like Tesla has gotten the last laugh. That's because Tesla just won the prestigious Motor Trend Car of the Year Award. The award has been given out since 1949 by that popular auto magazine. And this marks the first time in the history of the award that the winning car did not have an internal combustion engine. So sorry, Mitt. Seems like Tesla is a real winner. The bad. Holly Solomon. Solomon, a 28-year-old Arizonan, was upset when she heard that President Obama had won re-election, and she was downright enraged when she heard that her husband, Daniel Solomon, didn't bother to vote in the election. Apparently, all that pent-up anger became too much to handle, so Mrs. Solomon decided to take it out on her husband by running him over. According to police, Mrs. Solomon felt that her family was going to face hardship if the president was re-elected, and she was only trying to scare her husband, not actually run him over. Her husband is currently in critical condition in the hospital. And the very, very ugly, Brian Fisher. Fisher, head of the right-wing Anti-Marriage Equality American Family Association, doesn't want the Republican Party to become more inclusive. On his radio show yesterday, Fisher said it's time to, quote, clamp down on immigration because Hispanics voted for President Obama. He said that Hispanics are socialists by nature because they come from Mexico, which is a socialist country. Fisher went on to say that Republicans can pander all they want to Hispanics, to immigrants, and it will not work. Let's hope Republicans choose to become more inclusive and choose not to listen to Fisher's comments, because they are very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Okay, Mark Carlin at BuzzFlash at truthout.org is writing that Eric Cantor was trying to promote the Petraeus scandal in October in order to hurt Obama's chances in the presidential election, that he was leaning on the FBI to move this case forward faster so that it could go public faster so that it would hurt Obama. That's why Eric Cantor didn't go public with it. It's why Eric Cantor didn't call up the White House and say, Mr. President, you have a national security problem. Your CIA director is dropping his pants in the wrong place. He didn't do any of that. Instead, he tried to apparently, according to this, and there's several, Jill Mayer in the New Yorker lays out just this whole long thing. According to the Times, the New York Times, Cantor said he took the information and made certain that Director Mueller, that is Robert Mueller III, the director of the FBI, was aware of these serious allegations of the potential risk to our national security. Jane Mayer writes, this is a strange way to explain his contact with the FBI in this matter, because it's almost inconceivable that Director Mueller was not already aware that the bureau he runs had examined the email account of the director of the CIA and further confronted him in person. So what was Cantor really trying to convey when he got in touch with Mueller? And increasingly, it's looking like what he was trying to convey was, take this thing public, quick. There's an election coming up. It'll make Obama look bad. And Mueller, a Republican, if my memory serves me correctly, said, no, thank you. I think this is fascinating. Eric Cantor trying to... Amazing. Anyhow, Jack on the line in LaGrange, Illinois. Jack, you and I were talking when our phone system croaked. And my apologies that I don't...
Thanks for having me, Mr. Hartman.
Sure. I remember that that you disagreed with me, but I it's been a while. I don't remember about what. What were we talking about?
No, we were... I just feel like... And well, I'm going to say really quick that I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, and I'm not a conservative person who watches Fox News. But I just want to shout out really quick to CME and the CBOE traders. I'm confused about how this is like happened, and this is just for both parties, like just the corruption that's in like in both parties, how big corporations run America right now. Wait, are you there?
Yeah, I am. I would suggest that you find somebody, Jack. Yeah. Find somebody who is in their 50s or 60s, and is fairly lucid, or 70s, or 80s. And can describe to you what America was like before 1982 when Ronald Reagan stopped the Justice Department from enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and kicked off and changed the rules of how CEOs were compensated and how companies could be acquired, which made what Bain Capital does, which used to be a crime, legal, and kicked off an era. It was called the M&A frenzy, mergers and acquisitions. And Michael Milken and all these guys, you know, the big shots that got into the hostile takeovers and leveraged buyout artists and all that. It had such a bad reputation in the industry that they changed their name to private equity. But basically, this is what Reagan brought us was, you know, America as an oligarchy run by and for giant corporations.
Yeah, here's the thing, though. I'm not talking Reagan or Obama or Republican or Democrat. I just want, like, Democrats to understand that this man is financially corrupt. And
which
the Obama
man?
Administration. John Corzine.
John Corzine's in jail, isn't he?
No, he's not. He's not been financially prosecuted yet. He went in court and said, I don't know where the $1.2 billion went. But no, he's not in jail.
Yeah. Well, he probably will be.
I'll make clear.
But I don't disagree with you that John Corzine is probably a corrupt guy, you know, and a bad bankster, and that more banksters should go to jail. I would like the Obama administration to do what Reagan did. Reagan, you know, threw 800 banksters in jail during the SNL debacle and owned up to the fact that had he not deregulated the SNLs in 82 or 83, he wouldn't have had the SNL meltdown in 86, and he re-regulated them. In fact, he nationalized them. He took them over. He fired all the senior management, put federal bank regulators in their place. All the stockholders and all the SNLs lost pretty much everything. They all got a haircut. This is what Bush should have done in 2007 and 2008 when the big banking meltdown was going on. And Bush didn't have the courage to do. And by the time it got to Obama, it was a done deal. There had been two TARPs passed during the Bush administration, one in September and one in October of 2008. And the banks had been bailed out. The die was largely cast. Now, it's conceivable that Obama could have rolled that back, but boy, would it have been difficult.
But maybe I'm reading into this too far. And I get it. I'm a young adult, and I don't have as much experience as you do. But I find it funny, though, that Mr. Corzine just made a $500,000 donation to the Obama administration. Like, I just, as a kid, and
it's not possible.
And living in Chicago.
It's not possible.
And, like, being quote.
Hang on just a second. Let me interrupt you. It's not possible. You can't make a $500,000 contribution to an individual candidate. You can't do it.
Well, it's stated that he made some type of donation to the Obama. Like, what is possible?
What is possible is he could have given it to the super PAC that Paul Begala runs.
He made a $500,000 donation. I know people make donations. Because, I mean, you look at Goldman Sachs, a company that John Corzine used to work for.
Right.
They didn't make a donation. Big corporations, as you...
Goldman Sachs was all in for Mitt Romney this time around, by the way.
Quick, can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Goldman Sachs gave most of their money to Mitt Romney this time around.
They also gave, I think it was $800,000 to Barack Obama.
They spread their money around, but it was either 70-30 or 80-20 Mitt Romney.
Well, I just find it interesting, though, that once again, it's like these big corporations, and you agree with this, but they do run a company, and Democrats and Republicans have to own up to that.
Yeah.
They have to own up that John Corzine, among others, should be financially prosecuted. But the only reason why I point this man out more than others is because the Obama administration supports John Corzine.
I think they're prosecuting him.
Can you do me?
Justice Department is prosecuting him.
He's not in jail yet. Am I correct? He's not in jail.
Well, it takes a while, you know.
Oh, okay. He's not in jail yet. And I just want to make one more point clear.
Actually, I should say. Let me just put up for the record. I know virtually nothing about John Corzine or about his situation or about what's going on. So I may be wrong on some of these.
You didn't know about John Corzine.
No, I know who he is, and I remember when he got arrested or when he had the meltdown and all that kind of stuff. But I shouldn't be making specific statements about him because obviously you have paid a lot of attention to John Corzine. I have not. I frankly don't.
I probably shouldn't be paying this much attention. I just hate corruption. I hate corruption like most Americans. But the point I'm also just trying to make is, name one person. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe I don't know this much information, but can you name one person Barack Obama is financially prosecuted under his 4-year term? And people always say how the Republicans are so...
Yeah, actually, the guy at UBS in Switzerland, I can't remember his name now, I'm sorry, but there was a whistleblower at UBS who turned over the names of over 10,000 American millionaires and billionaires who were hiding money in UBS. Phil Graham is on the board of it, by the way.
I'm talking about bailouts.
And this guy is in jail right now. Now, I think that was a wrongful prosecution, but this guy's in jail. No, I'm with you. I want to see the Obama administration be more aggressive against these guys. Every effort to create a legislative framework or even a regulatory framework that would allow for the administration to be more aggressive at regulating our banks so that they can't do the kind of, gangster stuff that brought down the economy has been stymied, has been blocked, has been filibustered by the Republicans in the Senate. And this has got to be insanely frustrating to the Obama administration. It's bad politics. It's bad policy. So I would say, Jack, if you really want banksters to go to jail, you should be calling the Republicans in the United States Senate who have been blocking legislation that would make it easier for those banksters to go to jail. Thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I got to find out what's up with John Corzine now. How am I? 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, very interesting. Okay, here's the... Corzine searches for what's next. A year ago Wednesday, John Corzine left the elevator and headed out the door after a marathon weekend effort to fail to save MF Global Holdings. Apparently, he's come up with most of the money to cover the $1.6 billion that belonged to his customers, but they're still trying to decide who to blame for misusing the money. Former Goldman Sachs Group chairman and New Jersey governor has expressed worry about the chance he could lose his license to work in the securities industry. So, see, I thought he was being prosecuted. I was wrong on that. So, thank you, Sue, and, the folks in the chat room for setting me straight. So why is this kid calling up and going off on John Corzine? I mean, was he, dating his daughter and he said, no, you can't see her anymore or something? The Washington Times is all over it, Shano says. Oh, okay. So, one of the right wing rags has gone hysterical on Corzine and Eric Holder, yeah, of course. So what happens? I get the phone calls. Larry in Winchester, Kentucky. Hey Larry, what's up?
Hey Mr. Hartman. How are you doing?
I am very well, thank you. What's on your mind?
Oh good. Hey Mr. Hartman. Okay, I mentioned to your call screener that I am a priest. Okay, I am a priest. I am ordained.
As in Catholic?
No.
Okay.
I hold the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood.
Spoken
of in a book. Okay, now, sir.
Okay. The thing about everything that I'm listening from, I do not understand. I do understand a portion of the left side that we need, that you're saying that we need federal government to help those that you and I cannot help.
Right, that there are some things where the scale is so large or the problem is so big that if all of us pitch in a little tiny bit, then those of us who really need a lot of help can get it. Yes.
Well, yeah, but there are people out there that are taking advantage of the system. And there now there's 47 million people right. on food stamps or welfare, I don't know which. They're in HUD houses. I have talked to people in HUD houses. I have talked to the minority up in Gary, Indiana. They told me what they do is they hide their assets from the government, take advantage of the government, and they get pretty well off.
I don't believe you.
Well, I have talked to him. I'm a priest, and I will not lie to you.
I don't believe you on that either. I didn't believe Ronald Reagan when he said that there was a welfare queen who was driving in with a Cadillac, and the New York Times spent 6 months investigating it, that she was going to pick up her welfare checks. No, Gary, I'm sorry. I don't believe you. When somebody says something like that, that yes, a minority told me that they're living high and they're doing well come on. This is the kind of saddest edge, the saddest fringe of the oh my God, they're going to take it away from me mentality that Fox News and right-wing talk show hosts have foisted upon you, Larry. And I feel really sad for you that you would even, that you would take it to that next step and just, hallucinate stuff or make stuff up and then call a radio show and try and put it out. Yes, there are people who are abusing the system. Yes, there are people who are taking food stamps or welfare and probably don't qualify for it or who are not working, not because they can't work, but because they don't want to. Yes, absolutely. The best guesses of people who have looked at poverty and unemployment over the years, good sociologists and anthropologists, is that it's between 2 and 3% of the population. It's a very small percentage of the population of what they refer to as the long-term or hardcore unemployed, people who are actually mentally ill. By societal standards, they're unwilling to work. They're capable of it, but they're unwilling to. So the question that we all have to ask and answer, since we're voters, the question that we have to ask ourselves is, as a country, are we willing to say, okay, there's going to be 2 or 3% of freeloaders out there, so we're going to cut off all the benefits that are necessary for the lives of the other 97% of the people who are receiving benefits to punish those 3%? Or are we simply going to say, 3% getting away with it is kind of the cost of doing business? It's just like a retail store. Macy's is right next door to the TV station where we work. And they've got a shoplifting problem. Every retail store does. They got these metal detectors on the way out and things, to try and stop people. But they lose things. And it's probably 1, 2, 3% of the population that's stealing from them. Do they say, okay, screw it, we're going to go out of business? We're not going to offer clothing anymore? No. They do what they can to minimize the shoplifting, and then at a certain point you say, okay, this is just a cost of doing business. One of my cousins gave birth to a child with spina bifida, with her spinal cord exposed. This child was profoundly retarded, never learned to speak English. My cousin always hoped that her daughter would someday speak. When she was 5, when she was 9, she finally died in her late teens. And this devastated this family. And they were not wealthy to begin with. And Social Security came in. Social Security is a safety net program. One third of all Social Security payments do not go to retired people. They go to people like my niece, my cousin's daughter. I guess that's a niece, right? Yeah, I think. Maybe not. I don't know. That's whatever. They go to people like that. And that allowed that family to survive and to care for her. And I'm not willing to give that up. just to get revenge on 2 or 3% of the freeloaders. I'm not that small. I'm not that paranoid. Coming up tomorrow on our program, what's really going on with our economy? How are we affected by what happens in Europe? What happens if we go over the fiscal cliff? Answers to these questions and more when economist Dr. Richard Wolff joins me for a special Conversations with Great Minds. And get your questions ready. He'll be taking your calls, too. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.